And now to one of the country's most eminent historians, Mark McKenna, and his new book, The Shortest History of Australia. Don't be fooled by the title. It packs a lot in and brings Indigenous history into sharper focus at the forefront of the national story. I've been talking to Mark about the book. Mark McKenna, welcome to Saturday Extra.
Thanks, Nick. It's great to be with you.
Mark, you have called this the shortest history of Australia, but was one of your intentions to tell the story in a more expansive way, to bring to the fore aspects of the national narrative that have been shortchanged in the past?
Yes, definitely. No, expansive is a great way of describing it, Nick. Thanks. I guess there's two things, you know, I'm trying to do in the book. I'm trying to find a way to show how we can see Australian history differently. And related to that, I'm trying to do that in a different way. I'm trying to tell the story in a different way by the way that in how the book is structured and so on. And, of course, I decided not to go down the route of a chronological history. I didn't want to sort of get trapped in the same story of national formation. I felt I had to find another way. And I really did want my reader to pick the book up and ask, well, is this a history of Australia? And to spark interest by doing that, you know, to open up a sense of what Australian history can be. And, you know, one of the questions for every Australian historian tackling their nation's history now is how do you incorporate, how do you write about 65,000 years of human habitation, Indigenous history, and how do you carry that throughout your narrative? So that's what I've tried to do in the book, is to make Indigenous history central and carry it with me every step of the way. And all of those questions, in a way, you know, seem more pressing, I guess, in the wake of the referendum loss in October 23. So, you know, there's a danger that you can just start with Indigenous, the pre-British settlement story of Indigenous Australia, and then sort of cameo appearances throughout, you know, that's it kind of thing. So I wanted to avoid that approach. I wanted to, you know, to make it the center of the story in a sense, which is what I've tried to do.
Yes, this is important, isn't it? Because the Indigenous history is woven into every single chapter. As you say, you only had 65,000 words to deal with 65 millennia of continuous civilization. But one thing you obviously set out to do was to elevate the Indigenous story.
Yeah. The book starts with, I guess, the elephant in the room, and that is, you know, what I call the founding lie of Australian history. It begins with trying to show the reader that the dominant story that occupied Australian public life and culture for nearly 200 years was that Australia was settled peacefully rather than the land being taken by force. And that's really the founding lie of Australian history, that idea that was there and had such a purchase on the society for so long, that Australia was settled rather than invaded. And also with that, you know, the idea that Aboriginal people occupied the time that we call used to call prehistory, a time before real history began. You know, that history of denial isn't just about frontier violence. It's also about the denial of Indigenous law, cultural knowledge, all of the languages, over 400 languages spoken throughout the continent, a name for every place, every feature of the landscape, also in the sky, a name for everything. And I think we're still coming to terms with that. The fact that our constitution, for example, still excludes Indigenous people. So throughout the book, I've followed that through and tried to show how Indigenous history is part of every aspect of Australian history. It's not just something that precedes, for example, is the customary way it's thought of, you know, precedes British settlement, but it's actually part of, once the British come here, Indigenous history is inherently part of settler history. Settler history is inherently part of Indigenous history.
The frontier wars feature a lot in the book, the violent history of dispossession. You talk about the Black War from 1824 to 1832. I dare say there are many Australians listening to this who would not have heard of the Black War. Tell us about that and tell us how that kind of history has been buried in many ways.
Yeah, well, the Black War, of course, refers to Tasmania in the late 1820s and earlier 1830s. And, you know, specifically to Governor Arthur's attempt to gather together a band of settlers and force Aboriginal people into the southwest corner of the island, and to remove the threat of Indigenous violence, indigenous attacks on settler properties from the settlers, right? And for a long time, it was thought that, of course, the indigenous people of Tasmania were pretty much wiped out, made extinct, etc., in that first those first decades of colonisation in Tasmania, which, of course, is not true. But the war was central. It was central to the creation of Tasmania, as those wars were central to the creation of every colony and state in Australia. And I think one of the things that, you know, the Tasmanian story and the story of Truganini, you know, whose skeleton was kept in a museum in Melbourne, that this story is so, so central to the way Australia was created. It's part of our founding history. And, you know, one of the things that's always intrigued me about Gallipoli is that Australians have created a national myth of the formation of their nationhood offshore, you know, 16,000 kilometres offshore, when really the country was created through events like the Black War, through massacres, which we've now, you know, are now well documented throughout the continent. It's those wars that often weren't fully documented, and we do have to rely a lot of the time on Indigenous oral history. That's where the true foundation, the true creation of this nation lies, to my mind.
Yeah, that's one of the crucial arguments of the book, isn't it? The origin story of modern-day Australia is in Australia. It is not on a beach in Turkey, Gallipoli, where a lot of people see, you know, the new federation as being sort of baptised in the blood of the diggers who lost their lives there. A recurring theme of the book, as well, is the unacknowledged debt that modern Australia owes to Indigenous Australia. You write, in so many parts of Australia after 1788, Europeans would never have survived, let alone settle, without the Indigenous knowledge of water.
Yes, that's right. Because you can imagine, especially in northern Australia, central Australia, drier parts of the southeastern colonies, one of the great difficulties for settlers, of course, you know, the people coming into so-called new lands, was, you know, how they would sustain their herds, their sheep, their cattle, where was the water? And Indigenous people, as we've, as historians have shown, you know, for decades now, but it takes so long for these ideas to seep in to our national imagination. The whole pioneer kind of myth, the whole idea that, you know, people went out and settled and expanded and created wealth and so on, of course, is totally dependent on the knowledge that Aboriginal people shared about their land, about water being one important resource, but also paths, directions, you know, how to get from one place to the next. And then we go from that to the crucial role that Indigenous people played in securing industries like the pastoral industry, sugar industry in the north, so many other industries throughout Australia. They are central to Australia's economic success and performance.
On ABC Radio National, I'm Nick Bryant. This is Saturday Extra, and I'm talking with the historian Mark McKenna, who's written a new book, The Shortest History of Australia. Mark, it's a thematic history, as you say, rather than a linear narrative. You have this chapter, Fire and Water. Was this an attempt to place environmental history in a more central way in the Australian story?
Yeah, glad you asked that question, Nick. Yes, definitely. I mean, one of the things, it's thematic, as you say, it's a thematic history, but I guess also all of the chapters, I tried to show how they're all connected, interconnected, and to make them reflective. And with Fire and Water, I wanted to show that something as visceral, as real as fire, that Australians, you know, most of us live with the possibility that everything we own, many of us maybe, if not all of us, that everything that we own can be wiped out in one instant. And there's an existential threat, you know, that we grapple with living in this continent. There are many, actually. And I wanted to show how the continent shapes us, you know, as a people, how the land is a force, a historical force, an historical agent in its own right. In that chapter, for example, I go into the human emotional and psychological response to, in 2020, to the fires that we all remember, and try and make this part of Australia's national history as well. You know, that not just the political response to fire or the way we manage fire, but to look at the human level, to really write about the existential threat and to write about the emotions and the way that we have tried to grapple with fire and flood, but especially fire.
Yeah, it's a really powerful chapter. Now, Mark, there's an intellectual tradition in Australia of national self-belittlement, Donna Horne's Lucky Country, a title which has been misappropriated, a thesis that's been often misunderstood, created the idea that Australia was just lucky. You had the cultural cringe thinking that was pushed by A.A. Phillips in the 1950s. You had Arthur Boyd's The Australian Ugliness. There was a whole kind of grouping of intellectuals and work that kind of created this sort of superstructure of self-belittlement. And one idea that took hold, which again is self-belittling, is that Australia did not have much of a history to speak of. No Gettysburg, no War of Independence, no Pearl Harbor. You push back very strongly against that idea.
Yeah, I do. I do. It's a great question. Firstly, you know, let me start with, you mentioned Donald Horne. I mean, one of the things that I should bring in Manning Clark here too as well, because, you know, one of the things that this generation of Australian intellectuals, I think, sort of pushed, especially Manning Clark, was that, you know, Australians were colonials, right? Our history was a colonial history and we were in the hands of the British and therefore we didn't make our own history because we were the offshoot of another society. And that idea, you say belittlement, right? That's very true. It was an idea that somehow our history was made elsewhere, that it wasn't made here. Of course, it's completely wrong because Australians, and I'm talking there about colonial Australians and post-Federation, created their own history, fought for their own democracy. And when I say fought, I don't mean the American Revolutionary sense. Of course, I mean fought as in campaigned for, argued for, passed legislation, and so on. That's the kind of history that Australians did create for themselves. So it's a great failure, quite tragic, really, that idea that Australia, because it was an offshoot of Britain, that it therefore didn't make its own history. You know, that's a spectacular failure to appreciate. And if you believe that, then you'll believe Australian history is boring, right? Or that it is really inferior to other countries. I mean, like you, I studied American and European history at Sydney University in the late 70s, not Australian history. And it wasn't until I actually lived in Germany in my early 20s, where Germans, you know, I was living in a share house with lots of politics students, and they would ask me about Australian history, especially Indigenous history. And I, you know, I'd give them some broad brush answers, but I didn't know a lot of detail. And that's where my interest was sparked. In Australian history was trying to answer their questions. So I think it's something that historians, you know, the recent generation have really overturned that idea that was very, very dominant at the time of Horne and Clark.
Often you have to leave Australia to fully appreciate Australia. I think that's certainly with me on compulsory voting and things like this. Yeah, Mark, I mean, some people might read this book and say you have understated the story of national success. You do speak about how Australia built this very distinctive democratic model. That really pushes back against Horne's central thesis that Australia was basically an imitative society that just basically copied the Brits. Certainly that was not true when it came to democracy. But some people would say, where's the story of the construction of these great cities which so many people around the world want to live in? Where's the story of the wonder from down under economy that has produced this extraordinary recession-free run? What would you say to people who would say you have focused too much on the dark aspects of Australian history and not enough on the successes?
Good question. I think I've got an answer for that. So, yes, I mean, I'm sure that you could say that. Again, this goes back to the decisions you invariably make when you decide what to leave in and what to exclude or what to minimise, you might say. I think that I do acknowledge successes, but I certainly don't go into chapter and verse about them. First thing I'd like to say is, you know, that even at the moment, you know, you can see this in the recent television documentaries, the one on SBS, The Idea of Australia. I mean, I haven't watched the Sky News one, Tony Abbott one yet. But I think there's a sense, and there has long been a sense, that we are forced into a position, this comes out of the history wars, the culture wars, where we have to choose between narratives of our national history. We have to, for example, choose between black armband or a more sort of positive spin like Tony Abbott's been pushing recently. You know, on the one hand, we've got this strand of racism and frontier violence. On the other hand, we've got a successful democracy. We've got the fair go. We've got economic prosperity, right? We've got these different strands, but they seem to travel on different tracks, right? And the actual truth is that all these strands of our history are entangled. They're meshed. Racism, the idea of Australia as a successful social democracy. I mean, we know, for example, that that was selective. It was, you know, it was equality for some, not for all. Anzac, immigration, white Australia, all of these aspects of our past are inseparable. They're part of the same story. And I think one of the challenges we have now is how can we be critical of our nation's history? And by that, I mean, you know, critical of aspects of things that happened from, this is the present, of course, it's not the past. But at the same time, how can we be optimistic? How can we still look history in the eye, look it in the face, see it for what it was, acknowledge what happened, and not somehow then say, oh, you know, well, if you do that, then you're dumping down on Australia, etc. You know, we have to really find a way of avoiding getting out of this binary of we've got to choose between shame and pride.
History is an argument without end. Mark McKenna, thank you so much for joining us on Saturday Extra.
Thanks, Nick. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Mark McKenna's new book is called The Shortest History of Australia, and it's published by Black Ink Books. And I said there, The Australian Ugliness was written by Arthur Boyd. It was Robin Boyd, of course, the architect, not the painter. Apologies for that.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.